As we return to this third and final portion of today's seminar, we're going to talk a little bit about communication concerns and roles in relationship. So one of the things that was highlighted in a 2006 article by Orenthal and Van Steenwagen was some of the differences of opinions that tend to happen in relationships. And we're going to look at this because this is quite a cause of concern in many of the relationships that we deal with in counseling. We see oftentimes that in relationships, one person tends to be more of a private person, one tends to be more of an outward person. One tends to prefer more personal space. The other feels like, you know, they constantly want to be around their partner. They may have differences of opinion about roles, but you see that usually in relationships that partners are at each end of the continuum. We see this when we talk about conflict management, that a lot of times one partner will want to dive right in and deal with and solve the problem right away and almost talk nonstop about it, even when it's unhealthy to do so, whereas another one says, whoa, I need a pause. And we need to walk away. So we need to find a way to balance this out. But one of the main things that they talk about is the idea of who owns the task and who executes the task. I'm going to give you an example from their literature. So in their literature, they talk about how there was a couple that had an upcoming anniversary. Usually the husband was the one who mowed the lawn and took care of the yard work. But this time, the husband had some extra requirements on his job, so he wasn't able to do it at the usual time. So the wife was like, you know, every year, our anniversary, we do something together, so I don't want him to have that burden when he comes back, and we're not going to get to have any time together if we don't find a way to get the lawn mowed. So she went ahead and she tried to do it herself. Well, when she did it, the husband came back, instead of being excited that she had taken the task upon herself so she didn't have to do it, he was frustrated. He was downright angry because the lines were not lined up right according to what he was used to doing for each row in the lawn mowing. Just the task wasn't done the way it normally is done. So the interesting thing is that can cause an effect with their time for their anniversary. And so in the article by Orenthal and Van Swagen, they talk about it's important for couples to look at who owns a task and who executes it. So there were assumptions made on the part of both people in the example I just gave. The assumption was that yard work and mowing the lawn were things that the man was supposed to do. Might not have been exactly said out loud, but it always seemed like that certain day of the week or month, that was his stuff to do. And not only that that was his task, but that even when he's unavailable to do the task, it's not something that he prefers someone else to do because he has a certain way of doing it. So he not only owns the task, but he also executes the task. So their suggestion in an incident like the one that I just described with him and his wife is for the wife to bring up her concern about them not spending time for the anniversary. For example, she could say stuff like, I'm concerned because I don't want us to miss our anniversary get together, and I know you've been called away to some tasks on your job. I realize that usually you do the lawn and the yard work, but I wanted to see if it's possible if we can come up with a way to get that done so it doesn't intrude on our anniversary stuff. Then the authors of this article propose that in the couple, they should ask the question, what can I do to get you to assist me or to change your task on such and such day? So basically, there's a discussion of what happens if someone else usurps their task. Is that okay? because we talked earlier about assumptions and how dangerous assumptions are, how they can lead to toxic thoughts. So this is another area where we can see that assumptions can play in. What does each person need to consider in terms of his or her needs in the task? And then finally, what weapons does each try to do to make the other help with tasks or to avoid tasks? So those are some discussions that may be helpful when we're talking about promoting health in a relationship. I know they're not things that just naturally come to mind usually, but those are things that are real helpful for us to talk about to prevent future conflict. I always tell clients, you know, we can plan for conflict. We can decide an action plan of how we're going to handle it, of how we're going to use the I messages, of what we're going to do to solve problems more effectively. And one of the ways we can plan for it is by having those discussions about assumptions that we oftentimes don't talk about. Now let's jump to another thing that I alluded to earlier on as an example of the red flags to watch out for in relationships. I talked about have to versus choose to. And like I said, some of my past clients said one of the most freeing thing for them was changing their language from have to choose to. So even when they felt a sense of obligation, for example, one woman said, if I don't clean up the house, no one else around here will. I just have to do everything. And it may be true that her relatives weren't quick to do things around the house. But just changing the language of choose to gave her the freedom of, you know what? Maybe, even though it's tough to see things let go to a degree, I can back away and allow them the frustration of seeing what it's like to have these tasks undone. Allow them to have to think about, okay, she's not going to jump in every time. So using choose to is really a language of liberation. There's freedom in having options. Overall stress is reduced when we use choose to instead of have to. And it reminds a person that what they want is just as important as what the other people want. Now we've talked about the use of I messages as a healthy way of explaining what we want in a relationship. One variation of that is what I call the communication game. In the communication game, we are basically using the I message in reverse to hear and paraphrase what the other person, our partner, is going through. We want to make sure we hear those three key components. What they're feeling, why they're feeling that, how they would describe the situation, and what it is that they really want to happen in terms of behavior. We want to get essentially three yeses to, yeah, you're understanding how I'm feeling. Oh, yeah, you understand the situation as I see it, and you understand what it is I'm really wanting. So, if at any point the listener doesn't accurately hear the feeling, they can ask a question. Oh, I thought you were feeling such and such. Can you tell me again what it is that you're really feeling so I understand? They could also clarify the situation as their partner sees it. Oh, I thought you were frustrated because of blah, blah, blah. But actually, it sounds like you're frustrated because of something else. Help me understand the situation as you see it. And we could finally clarify what it is in terms of the behavior they really desire. This I have seen make the most difference in terms of communication with couples. Because a lot of times we use words that may sound similar, but they're not exactly the same for the listener and for the person talking. I remember one couple I dealt with. The man had moved out of the home. They were having marital frustrations for some time. He had moved out on his own. They remained married and visited each other every now and then while they were in counseling with me to see if they could repair their marriage. And they were doing the paraphrasing exercise to try and understand where each other was coming from. And I remember him saying, "Well, you're sad because I'm just not there at home." And she burst into tears. She said, "Sad? I'm just desperate. I'm just in despair because I've waited a year now and you're nowhere to be found. I'm really wondering if you ever even intend to come back. Tell me about what your goal is." Initially, I realized it was for us to work on the marriage, but now I'm not sure what your goal is. Can you please clarify that? You hear the difference in how we can use that communication game to clarify. To the guy, she was just sad. To her, she was in despair. She really just felt like giving up. She wasn't sure that the marriage could be repaired at this point, or that he was even interested in that goal. There are some particular suggestions that I've heard at seminars that I've attended for when you communicate with men. I found this interesting, but I've also found it to really, really work with the situations that I've dealt with. Men communicate different from women, if you've observed. So women, they may talk in circles. If you ask them how their day is, they may say, "Well, first this happened, then that happened, now such and such." And oftentimes the receiver's left feeling like, "Well, what is it that she's really trying to say?" Whereas with men, they found that they're more focused on solving the problem. What's the matter? How do we get to the solution? So the suggestion in terms of how men's brains are wired that this neuropsychologist offered was, she said, it's best to actually start with the end result when you're talking with a guy. So for example, if a gentleman says, "Well, how was your day?" The person that's responding might want to say, "Well, as I tell you about my day, I'm really just wanting you to sit next to me and hug me because I want to share about all the feelings that I had in this day." When a woman or a man does this to another man in communication, it actually turns on the part of their brain that deals with the role expectation of, "Oh, just sit and listen, just hug, just pay attention," or "Problem solve. Okay, go into action mode. The person talking is looking for a solution." So another example, let's use the same situation. The gentleman's asking, "How was your day?" And the person talking says, "You know, I ran into someone I hadn't run into in a while, and it didn't go well. I'm wanting to share with you what I did and what I think from this point in terms of my interaction with that person. But I'm going to want some feedback from you." Now, in the second example, that tells the man who's listening, "Oh, listen initially. She's made a decision, but she wants some feedback and problem solving. Then fill in the details." I have found this when I've done marital counseling and helped facilitate communication with couples just to work well. I've also found it to work well when I have people coming for work-related concerns to counseling, and they're wondering, you know, how they're going to deal with certain work stresses, and they're trying to communicate with a male supervisor. Because what happens in the neuropsych world, they actually see that with women, more areas of their brain are in gear all the time, whereas with men, the problem solving and solution part of their brain is highly in gear, and the other parts are not as much in gear unless you key them in. So these are things to consider when we're talking about maximizing the effectiveness of relationship and minimizing toxicity. Now, when we're talking about relationship, I have the question come to me a lot from clients. What if the other person is the one who really caused an offense or did something, but yet I'm the only one who's willing to come into counseling? Do you think that'll do any good? And my answer is yes, because Even if one or the other party comes into counseling, we can still look at the toxic thought patterns, the assumptions, and how to change those. If any one person in the system decides to make changes, it causes the other person to have to evaluate what they're doing. So cognitive behavioral methods for either party or both parties are very useful. Ideally, it's good if both parties can work individually and then also as a couple in terms of working on that relationship. But that doesn't always happen. So we look at the red flags, the things like shoulds, things like why. Why is a dangerous question? Because it leads to circular thinking instead of what next? How can I approach this differently? Which are more behavioral ways of looking at things. Another thing that we'll target in terms of cognitive behavioral interventions is the phrase, if only. If only such and such, then such and such. The thing with if only is it leads us to believing that things are more linear than they really are in life. We just talked about have-tos also being a red flag. And that magic word, enough. I always say, enough according to whom? If only I had done enough. That leads to a lot of frustration in relationships. And any type of absolute thinking is another thing we want to target in our therapy with clients. Things like always and never, good and bad, right and wrong. I actually give a lot of handouts, and one of the types of handouts I'll give has to do with the thinking error types. And as I teach them, if I'm working with a couple together, or even if I'm working with one individually, before I teach these, I will preface it with, this isn't a time to think about what the other person does wrong and all the examples of what he or she has done wrong to you. This is a time as we're going through these to self-evaluate, to pull back, to see if there's any examples you can think of where you're like, oh, I should have done this instead of this other thing. So the first one I'll go over is awfulizing or catastrophizing. The error that's inherent in this is the person's only predicting negative outcomes for the future. They're just looking at a catastrophe. If such and such happens, it's just awful, it's terrible, I can't go on, my life is over. So even if there are some good and some bad, they don't even see the light in the midst of the darkness. They just see all the negativity. And you see where that can lead to toxicity in a relationship. Another thinking error type we'll look at is disqualifying and discounting. This is another variation of the one I just talked about. This person overlooks the positive. They basically believe that the good doesn't count. I'm sure even when people compliment me, they really don't think that good about me. And it's hard to argue with that when someone's thinking that and they believe that. Another thinking error type is the all or nothing. Viewing the situation as a black and white concrete situation. I'm the worst person. I must be a good mom if I do A, B, and C. I guess I just must be a rotten mom because my kids aren't listening. Everything always goes your way. Nothing ever goes my way. So the problem in that all or nothing language, there's not a lot of room for discussion. So one way we use the cognitive debating strategies to deal with that is to look for exceptions. There's definitely times in life where there's exceptions to this all and nothing types of thoughts. So we're able to look at, can we consider sometimes where that does not occur and what does that look like? Another one is someone whose frustration tolerance is so high, they believe that things are so inconvenient that they can't stand things, they can't tolerate them, they're unbearable. Now, that might mean because they need to learn some skills. We might need to do some skill development with them. We might need to teach them behaviors. which are solutions that we can actually really do in the session. It might mean that they have some emotional ability and difficulty controlling their emotions, and we need to work with that as well. It might mean that they have some negative cognitive schemas, like I talk about in the seminar on Axis B personalities, where we have to go back and maybe look at some family of origin things or some relationship problems they've had in the past. Another type of thinking error that I'll teach clients about is the error of self-downing, self-deprecating thoughts. I'm no good. I'm worthless. I'm useless. I'm a failure. That can also play into that all or nothing. This didn't work out right, so I must be a failure. Another thinking error isn't just self-downing, but other downing. Derogatory comments and all or nothing negativity towards another person. We can also look at emotional reasoning as a thinking error. When something feels so strong and so overwhelming, we can pretend as if it's actually a truth, not just a feeling. One of the other thinking errors is labeling. Sometimes we can stereotype things. We can look at things like all of them, all of the people in this category are like that. And it may be that our experiences have seemed that way, but to put a label is very limiting and toxic in a relationship, rather than coming out of a relationship by letting the other person show through their behavior and their actions how they are. A ninth thinking error that we teach on is mind reading, trying to predict things. And why is this difficult? Is because we're looking at limited aspects of a situation. We're saying, you're going to turn out to be on the streets if you keep doing blah, blah, blah. You're going to end up with no one in your life because no one likes anyone like you. So that causes toxicity in relationships. Overgeneralizing can also be a thinking error that we want to avoid. With overgeneralizing, we're making broad conclusions about an event, again, based on very limited information. My husband doesn't love me because he's always busy. So we're making an assumption from a behavior that may or may not be correct. We can again use the cognitive debating skills to look at, is there any other reason why your husband might be busy other than he just doesn't love you and doesn't care to be around you? An 11th thinking error is personalizing things. My wife is quiet. Something must be on her mind. So, you know, people who look at things as something's always about them. And finally, the shoulds that we talked about. I should or ought to do A, B, and C. Things should be this certain way. So there are some guidelines for clean, healthy communication. These are things we really want to teach and instill in our clients. Things like avoiding judgmental words. I really highlight just avoiding adjectives in general. Because even when in relationships when people give compliments like, wow, that was so nice of you. You're really kind and caring. That can also work against them because they can say, so you think I was kind and caring because I gave you this today, but you didn't think I was kind and caring the other day? So instead, we really just want to stick to behaviors. We want to avoid global labels. We want to avoid stereotypes. Of course, avoiding you messages that we talked about. Avoiding bringing up old history in the current conversation, because that will tend to snowball the whole conflict. And if there's an immediate problem that needs to be solved, it's best for the couple to look at what is the current issue at hand. That's why making concise statements like the I message and using the communication game are very helpful, because that way we can look at what is the problem as I currently see it, and what is the issue that needs to be solved or decided on. We want to avoid negative comparisons, because comparisons are deadly. They really go nowhere. Avoiding threats. When someone shares their feelings, we want to help teach our clients how to describe or name their feelings rather than using it as an attack. So, for example, I feel put down when words like this, this, this are used, rather than, you're always putting me down. You can never say anything nice about me. You just think I'm a nobody and can't do anything right. So you see, that second example could set the couple up for a lot of problems. And we also want to teach them with clear and clean communication, it's not just what's said, but also what's communicated with nonverbals, that their body language should follow and match what they're saying. Another thing that I'll give in terms of handouts and go over with clients in terms of helping promote healthy relationships is looking at what I call the guidelines for fighting fair. I will actually usually give this as a homework assignment and have each party look at it individually, kind of grade themselves on how they think they do these. What's interesting to me is most often people are pretty hard on themselves, usually even harder than their spouse or their partner is on them. So the first one they'll look at, do I consider my relationship a long-term commitment not to be discarded because of disagreement, no matter how serious it may be? And I've had couples that say, you know, I say I'm in this for the long haul, but I guess my behavior really isn't showing that. I guess deep down, I really have been given the vibe that I'm out the door. Another one that they'll evaluate is, do they agree to listen to the other's feelings, even if they consider it inappropriate? So again, when the person's giving the I messages, they're not debating whose feelings are right or wrong, whose perceptions of situations are more accurate. They're just listening for understanding. So they're not guessing what they want to say next. They're not ready to jump in and counterattack. With fighting fair, the couple's also committing to honesty and acceptance. Now, it's important that both those words are there, honesty and acceptance. I've had couples that said, you know what? I'm honest about how I feel with my partner, but I really struggle with accepting what that other person says about me. And so you see, both elements are important for a healthy relationship. Another thing I'll highlight with couples in terms of the guidelines for fighting fair is that relationships really aren't this 50-50 thing that people have said. They're really 100-100. If each person is not going in giving his or her all, then it gives a misperception that we're really not seeing this as a long-term commitment. Another thing that healthy relationships do is they consider all the factors. They look at the context of a potential conflict before bringing it to their partner, before getting into an argument. Is there any possible reason why the other person might be acting this way, or why this might be happening? They limit their conflict to the here and now, to the present. They don't get into these global battles that really are hard to finish and fight. They eliminate global comments like you always, you never, or I can't, which is basically a substitute for I won't. They eliminate phrases like, I'll try, which basically is not a direct commitment to any behavior change. They eliminate the shoulds and the red flags we talked about. They focus on issues and behaviors rather than personhood. The other thing that we talked about with conflict management that fighting fair guidelines also highlight is that couples that are healthy allow for them to be a pause in between when there's tensions. It's okay for there to be time to come back and revisit the issue. Not so much days later or weeks later, but it's okay to come back and say, you know what, I'm going to go for a drive, or I'm going to go to the other room and think about this for a while. I'm going to write down some of my thoughts on this. But to set a time to come back, during that time, each partner should be writing some I messages. Because again, usually what they're first writing or thinking is usually a you message, not an I message. We also, as I said before, want to avoid things that are derogatory about their partner's personality. And we want to consider them as someone that can actually be used as an instrument to show us some of the things that need to be changed in our life. Even if your partner doesn't stick to these guidelines, I encourage each person to be the one who follows the guidelines. We want to avoid those thought patterns that were toxic, that we talked about the thought errors a little bit ago. Things like trying to read the other person's mind. It's okay to share, like I said with the iMessage, but keep things in a balanced way. Also, one of the concepts I try to work with my couples about is avoiding the idea of winning or losing. If the relationship loses, then everybody loses. No one really wins or loses. We have to re-envision a relationship as two people fighting against this outside thing that's trying to destroy the relationship, rather than fighting against each other. I always tell couples that, you know, you're putting a face on your enemy. And that face, you're saying that my partner's my enemy. Rather than this outside issue that we can't agree on and work through as the enemy. With fighting fair, there may be some topics that need to be out of bounds. This is something that couples might want to talk about. One way to make a shift from some of the blaming types of communication to healthy communication might be to say something like, if we could do A, B, and C behavior, then such and such might happen. So we want to try and talk again in terms of behavior. So let's continue down to this next part here about telling ourselves the whole truth. One of the things that I often teach couples is that a lot of times there's a part truth and a part lie in what we're saying. So, for example, my friends must not want to be friends with me anymore, because they haven't called me in a while. Well, there might be something to reevaluate about the friendship, but maybe it's not that they don't want to be friends. Maybe they're busy. Maybe there's other things of going on, you know, in their life. So let's look at some examples and telling yourself the whole truth. First one, my friend is quiet today. I know it's just a matter of time before she leaves. Just like everybody else in my life. So here, when I look at this at first glance, I see a schema in place. A schema of everybody in my life always leaves me. I see one of those red flags. Everyone. A negative global thing. So there's really not that much room for the friend to give an explanation. Instead, I might start with the observation and check in with a friend. It's important sometimes to just use direct questions. I would say your friend's name and then say, it seems like you're quiet today. Am I understanding that you might want to have some space by yourself? Can you help me understand why you're quiet? I encourage couples to use questions, open-ended questions, rather than accusations, rather than assumptions. What about the second one? I never have any good interactions with one of those people. They're slow, mindless, and just want to tell stories. They don't do anything useful in their lives. Well, we definitely hear some very negative, judgmental terms in there. Very absolute. And that phrase, those people. So maybe the person speaking has had some poor interactions that didn't go very well. But to categorize and stereotype all of them, it is basically saying, okay, I've already decided that this is how it's going to turn out. Instead of maybe using something like the communication game to talk with one of the people in that category. Let's look at this third example. It feels like everyone's eyes are on me. They all think I'm a loser. I see the way they look at me. Generalizing, negativity, overgeneralizing that, negative self-evaluation, projecting onto the others, they think I'm a loser. There's no checking in. Even if a number of people's eyes were on them, we could use some cognitive debating strategies with this particular person to see, could there be any other reason that people tend to be looking in your direction? Maybe there's something else going around you that they're looking at and it's not necessarily you. Maybe they're looking at you because of something good. The fourth example here says the only reason they were kind to me is because I'm the new person in the neighborhood. They really think I'm the strange out-of-town person who does not fit in. So we hear a lot of assumptions that are not tested. There's no way of checking them. Is this really true? Do they really think that? Is there any other way of looking at things? I must be the worst mother in the world because my son got a D on his test. We hear this mom personalizing things. She's not testing that there might be other reasons that her son got the D. Maybe he didn't study. Maybe it was hard for him to recall the information. Maybe things were worded on the test in a way that was hard for him to show what he knew. Let's look at the sixth example. I'm the ugliest creature ever created. Look at my face. It's uneven. My head looks like an egg. I have too many pimples. I'm so red that I look like I'm sunburnt year-round. That person's very self-deprecating. They tend to look at what they see as the negative qualities about themselves and magnify them over any positive. Let's look at a seventh example here. Nothing good ever happens to me. At every bend, there's only negative things. I know that things will not turn out well during my job interview. So they've already decided. They're sure. They've used this absolute nothing good happens. Things are just negative. So, and that could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe they'll go into the job interview already feeling like they're not going to get it and maybe not putting their best foot forward. What about I must be good, strong, and perfect to be happy with myself in life? Again, very absolute. If only I'm good, if only I'm strong, if only I'm perfect, then the good things in life will happen. And what I tell clients is there ever a time you can think of where you've noticed that someone was actually not that good, didn't do things very well, or didn't have right intentions, and things sort of turned out okay? Or where maybe someone made mistakes, even unintentionally. So it's not just linear that the good, right, perfect, strong people have great things turn out for them, and the bad, evil, awful people have bad things happen. Sometimes life turns out different. And let's look at this last and ninth example. I have to drive this old clunker and wear thrift store clothes. People really must think I'm a poor loser. I know when they see me in their neighborhood, they'll look down on me. Again, a lot of assumptions ahead of time. Could it possibly be, and I'd say this to the client, could it be that you're feeling concerned about wearing the thrift store clothes? You feel uncomfortable, so you're assuming that other people are too. Now let's jump to a few other issues in terms of dealing with relationships. One is the issue of having a higher power. That's how I know the AA group puts it. When I work with Christian clients, they'll say Jesus, their Lord, their Savior, is the person that they're following. Other people may have someone else. But what happens is this concept that AA calls a higher power is helpful because it puts things in perspective. That we cannot control everything ourselves, but there's someone or something outside of us that is in the mix. It's not just us in this toxic, unhealthy relationship. One of the things I will say that we want to avoid, and I've had to gently confront clients on this, is some people will actually make another person, the person they're in relationship with, into the role of the higher power. That's what happens ultimately when we're in a toxic relationship. For example, if you're in a relationship with a narcissist, someone who thinks too highly of him or herself, it's very easy, if you're a codependent, to put them into that role of higher power. They know better than I do. They can be a very charismatic person, and you start thinking, well, maybe they do know. But having a higher power, something in a spiritual sense beyond yourself, really helps put things in perspective. Even when things don't go the way we hoped, even when things feel out of control, there's another person in the mix. Higher power also puts in perspective the idea of making amends. Boundaries are another thing that we'll work with a client on in terms of helping them make a relationship more healthy. Boundaries show where one person ends and another begins. Boundaries, I tell clients, are some of the most loving things you can do. It's not your responsibility as a client, I'll tell them, to deal with whether or not the other person likes the boundaries. So, for example, when a client comes in and says they're taking on more tasks than they can, it's overwhelming, it's just too much, I'll look at, okay, what are some ways that they can give boundaries? I talk about what the literature calls a good no. No is a small word, but it can be powerful. When we carefully choose our no, it makes our yes more valuable. A lot of clients have a hard time saying the word no. They feel like it's cold, that it's cruel, that it's closing the door on communication. So what I'll teach them is to create an atmosphere where the word wait is in the mix. So for example, if we have a codependent woman who's always tending to jump in, who's tending to rescue other people, frustrated and her heart wants to say no, but is afraid that it's going to cause a negative chain reaction. When someone calls her next time to ask about her intervening and rescuing, instead of saying, oh, sure, yes, I'll do that, even though in her heart she feels no, she will use something like that communication game and say, oh, you're feeling overwhelmed because you really want to pick up your prescription and your groceries before such and such time, and you're having a hard time getting there. You're needing some help. Yeah, I am needing some help. It's getting down to the wire. Then create a healthy wait. So they'll say, okay, let me get back with you shortly. I'm going to have to look into things for about 20 minutes, and then I'll let you know. Now, she might have already known that she could or couldn't help, but that wait helps teach the person on the receiving end that they're not automatically going to get a yes. Then, if the person has to say no, it's a little easier. Like I said, the good no makes the yeses more valuable. Keep in mind, you know, one of the first things we teach our children, think of the terrible twos, is no. But yet, it's hard for us sometimes as adults to do that. A good no helps us focus on what can we legitimately do. We might not be able to do certain things, but there's some things we can legitimately do. So if this lady in the example that I just gave calls back and says, yeah, I know you were overwhelmed, focused on getting this stuff picked up. I wanted to tell you that I can help you, but it's not going to be until such and such time. So again, the use of boundaries. No can even be generous. No can help clarify for someone what your values and belief systems are. Now, I like to teach clients different types of no's. Instead of just bluntly saying no, there's ways that no can be given. There's the reflecting no that I just gave, acknowledging the other person's feelings and thoughts, and then giving a no. The reason no, giving a explanation, a genuine reason, without offering up negotiations. Something like, no, I can't help you with a concert. I actually have two big projects I got to work on. So you're giving an explanation. The broken record no. Sometimes people are in relationships with a toxic person who keeps trying over and over and over to get them just to agree to whatever. So sometimes a broken record approach might be best. As I told you a little bit ago, I'm not going to be able to help you today. Another time might be an option. There's another type of no called the pain now or pain later no. I'm not sure how my schedule will shape up today, so it's better I say no today than to let you down later. If I'm able to help, I will call you back and let you know, but I'm not sure that I can do that right now. There's something called a no sandwich also. This is really a nice no. So it's basically yes, no, yes. You're affirming the relationship, then you're saying no to the current request, and then thanking them for asking. I know this event is important to you, but I just can't see a way to help it right now. I do appreciate you asking me. So they affirmed the person's feelings and perspective. They ended up with an affirmation of that they want this friend to still come to them in the future. But in the middle, they were able to say, I can't do this right now. Then there's a contingent no, what they call the yes, if no. I can help you if you give me all the information by this certain date and have someone else do this part, then I can do this other part. The delayed no, which is basically what I was talking about, the wait, putting that time in there. Now, when we're talking about toxic people, it's really important to look at how healthy is it for someone to have a relationship with this person. I will highlight with a client that there's nothing wrong with reevaluating a relationship. There's nothing that says we have to stay at the same level of closeness or interaction in a relationship if it's a harmful relationship. So how do we know who the unsafe people are? People who demand what they haven't earned. People who refuse to admit their weakness. I say, you know, as long as both people are humble in a relationship and willing to work on things, that gives us something we can work through. But if someone's stubborn and unwilling to admit their weakness, then it's really hard to work on things. Unsafe people also tend to be defensive. they don't do that one element of the fighting fair where it says that they are appreciative and they listen to the feedback of the other person. Unsafe people work hard to stay unsafe people. They believe they're right. They may lie. They have a power orientation. There's manipulation. Whereas safe people, like I said, are humble. They're open to feedback. They want change. They use we language. It's not just about manipulation and what they can get, but they're willing to work as a team. So if you know someone has some toxicity, how do you deal with their behavior? There actually are ways of doing that, whether it's a client of yours or whether it's a client coming in asking how to do it with someone else in their life. The first way is to help put their behavior in context. Maybe they didn't learn certain skills growing up. Maybe manipulating other people or intimidating is what they've seen modeled and it's worked for them to a degree. They've always had people scared. Also, we can deal with toxic people by looking at the disturbances that are going on as maybe character flaws, by looking at their resistance to changing behaviors. One of the best things that I highlight in people when they're coming in, if it's possible they're in a relationship with a toxic other, is to trust their instincts. So if they're telling me a narrative or a story about something that doesn't add up, it doesn't feel right, they're not sure, I'll create a pause in there and say, okay, it sounds like you're saying mentally you're thinking up all these reasons why this might be off, but then behaviorally you're still staying in a relationship with them in the same way, doing the same things, no boundaries, that your instincts are telling you one thing, but you're still continuing in the relationship. Let's take a look at what you're struggling with. One of the other things the literature would suggest is that people in toxic relationships stop trying to empathize with things that are not okay. We find a lot of times that codependents and other people try to empathize and understand things that really aren't healthy. They also put a lot of energy into the other person's beliefs, needs, and values to where they kind of push down their own. And remember we talked earlier about the difference between love and pity. Oftentimes, the person that's in a relationship with someone who's toxic really is feeling pity. They're feeling sorry for that other person. So how do you know when you're maybe around a toxic person? They're self-focused. That's what their motivation is. Even when they're doing something that appears to be caring, it's not because it's genuinely caring. They're possessive. The person they're in a relationship with is basically an object. They're very all or none thinking. There's not humility, but there tends to be an abundance of pride. There may be a level of aggression. You see, some toxic people are overly sweet, and it's a cover for their anger and their whatever inside. But then other people, they may be outwardly aggressive. They may secretly have shame inside, but there's a lot of shame that motivates a toxic person. They're in denial of self-responsibility, and they're averting blame. So when someone's trying to manipulate you, some of the things we can teach our clients to do is that they have options. They have choices. They can choose to avoid the fight. Nothing says they have to remain in a situation that's toxic. They can create a pause and assess and evaluate the character of the other person. They can remind themselves that it's really unhealthy to care for another person. If this toxic person's not caring, we really can't do it for them. And actually, it's just going to make them buck against it more. we really can't correct what we didn't start. The only person we can take responsibility for is ourselves. And by not intervening, it forces a toxic person to decide if they're going to take responsibility for the things they created or if they're going to suffer the consequences. So back and forth is what we see in a relationship. They're, you know, toxic people aren't always 100% of the time toxic. That's what keeps codependents and people that are in relationships with toxic people coming back. Because they're charmed. They love the passion of the toxic person. They're intense. They seem to really know what they believe in. They give room for caretaking, seemingly. But set the person up for broken dreams, hurt, and disappointments. So it's this dance back and forth. I'm actually going to read a quote from Rosenberg's 2013 book that talks about the dance between a codependent and narcissist. Codependents find narcissistic dance partners deeply appealing as they are perpetually attracted to their charm, boldness, confidence, and domineering personality. When codependents and narcissists pair up, the dancing experience sizzles with excitement, at least in the beginning. After many songs, the enthralling and thrilling dance experience predictably transforms into drama, conflict, feelings of neglect, and being trapped. Even with chaos and conflict, neither of the two spellbound dancers dares to end their relationship. Neither of these two opposite, but dysfunctionally compatible, dance partners feel compelled to sit the dance out. That's where one of our jobs as a therapist is sometimes to let clients know it's okay to sit the dance out. Codependents oftentimes, unfortunately, are willing followers. They love the opportunity to care, give, and be there for others. Narcissists and manipulators, that's why they get unchallenged. The emotional up and downs create some drama and passion. So they're basically the perfect countermatch. There are some questions we can have our codependents or our people that are in toxic relationships think about. Is the narcissist really a charming, admirable leader? Or is he doing this just for a reason? It's an important question. Because the answer is usually narcissists and toxic people do things to get something. They're not, quote, just being kind. Is this person a strong, capable, take charge type of guy? Or is he or she a control freak who desires to have authority over every aspect of your life? Can you possibly maintain a relationship with someone when you're always the giver and never receive? Has it ever worked to this point in your relationship that you've ever consistently gotten back? Are you really as enthused and happy with the manipulator as you say you are? Are you more interested in predictable unpredictability? Or can it be willing to take a risk that there might be something new and better out there? If you don't end the roller coaster of chaos, where will you be? Even in a week or a month, in 6 months, a year, or several years? Since people generally tend to do more of the behaviors they're used to, are you ready to expect more of the same things you're describing? How would things be different if you could be empowered to choose your own partner based on logical, behavioral expectations and clear values and beliefs rather than just intense feelings? Problems is that a lot of times both the person in the relationship with the toxicity as well as the emotional manipulator or toxic person have suffered some really negative schemas in their childhood and their family of origin. There might be things like fears of abandonment, emotional instability. Trust is something that oftentimes they didn't see modeled. There may be abuse of various sorts. They might even have been a victim of deprivation of love or nurturance or affection. Shame oftentimes is at the core. Not just that their behaviors were off, but that they were a flawed person. They may have been taught entitlement, lack of self-control, impulsivity, emotional inhibition. There may have been a background that reinforced that they need constant recognition or approval. So how can we react when we hear these schemas? Before we start taking them apart and using cognitive debating strategies, we want to assess and observe. And we can, as we're doing this, we can also role model for our clients, the ones that are in relationships with a toxic person, how to assess and observe. Observe the lack of balance, the sense of unfairness, anxiety, despair. Identify the schema that fueled your helplessness in the situation. Distinguish between what was part of your past and what's actually happening now. Look at what are your usual tactics that you use. Can you plan ahead that you tend to use these tactics and then test them out to see if they're actually useful and helpful? And replacing your habitual schemas with more positive ways of looking at things. Boundaries. Boundaries are all about balance. What types of things are we trying to reinforce balance in our clients about? Balance between freedom to be themselves and to explore and set limits. Balance between dependency on their parents and independent rebellion. Balance between doing it on their own and receiving guidance. Balance between knowing about a person and knowing that person as they are. Balance between lecturing and listening. Balance between prying or probing and just asking. One of the neat phrases that I love in the literature is, be the boundary. Actions speak louder than words. All too often, the people that are in relationships with toxic others tend to behave in ways that don't reinforce the things they're saying they value. So, of course, that toxic person is going to be, well, you know, they're going to see that the other person continues in a relationship with them. Remember, boundaries are loving. They give freedom even for the other person to choose if they're going to behave poorly or if they're going to consider any changes. Consequences should be reality-based. And boundaries give the idea that people need to choose their battles. The context of boundaries is that they should be given in terms of a context that creates safety, structure, warmth, and unconditional positive regard. What's the price of not having boundaries? It's probably what our clients come to us with already. Unhealthy, toxic people in their life. They're attracted to and develop relationships for wrong reasons. Struggles with having genuine vulnerability. Struggles with intimacy. Unwillingness to accept responsibility for their behavior and blame of others. Healthy boundaries can create cognitive flexibility, give a capability to deal with negativity, open up an ability to do some grief work and counseling, and then move on and work toward healthy goals. Healthy boundaries reinforce that we do have choices. We can make our choices consistent with our life goals, with desired behaviors. And we can actually implement willingness to move on when needed. Healthy boundaries also help us realize that it's not wrong to need other people too. Healthy people. To reevaluate that law of thirds. Who's someone who's a neutral person or who could be helpful in our life? We can learn to trust again. We can state our beliefs and our needs. We don't have to censor everything. We don't have to ruminate and wonder and worry. We can develop healthy self-care and not take things personally. So how do we be realistic? Again, if there's been a pattern, which usually is the case, of being in relationships with toxic people, what are some reality-based approaches? So the first is helping a client to assess what they really want, and then to look at a behavioral plan for achieving it, and to consider an array of options. In the process, we want them to avoid that toxic word why that just leads to those circles. As they're evaluating this, they're going to look at who should own or take responsibility of various problems and whose responsibility is it for managing the solutions. I like what Al-Anon says. It says you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. We can't be responsible for other people's ways of looking at things and behaving. Now, we talk about how people in relationships with toxic others tend to confuse love and pity. The literature talks about love languages. We all have different ways we define love in terms of behaviors. Some people, it's words. Give me words of affirmation. Tell me how much I mean to you. Others, it may be quality, time, and attention. Other people still may prefer gifts, acts of service, or physical touch. One of the things that's really important is helping people identify what means love to them and how they communicate that to others. Oftentimes, the error that we make is that we try to communicate love to others in the way that we want to be loved rather than what means love to them. One of the best exercises I've done with couples when both of them have come in has been to ask them to write their, quote, 10 commandments of a healthy marriage. Basically, I'm not there to referee, but to hear what their values and beliefs are in terms of what they think the values, the assumptions need to be for things to work well. It could be beliefs about how much time healthy couples spend together, how they solve conflict, who does what chores. But oftentimes, there's areas that we'll look at in terms of how they have operational definitions. So things like trust, things like communication, things like love. We tend to toss around those words so freely, but, you know, everybody tends to define them differently. So I will actually use the idea of like a camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what behaviors would it see happening that would show love? What behaviors would it see that would show that trust? I remember one couple who came in and the lady was crying endlessly, saying that the week was awful between last time they had come for their session and the current session. And the husband saying he thought it went pretty well. I thought, wow, they're having some pretty big difference of opinion here. She eventually admitted that she felt bad because they're, quote, never together as a family anymore. So first of all, you hear that absolute never. We're never together. Then I had her define in concrete terms and behaviors what's together for her. She said, we used to all eat a meal as a family. Then we used to all do the same activity together. And the husband pipes in and says, you know what? We're together all the time. Again, very absolute thought. Gosh, how much more together do you want? Very different definition of together. He said, we're in the same room. The kids are teens. I got work. You have other things. The meal's ready. Let people eat when they need to. We're in the same room. And the wife continues crying and saying, but the one child's on their laptop. The other child's playing video games. You're doing stuff for work. I'm doing whatever. We used to sit down at the same time, all together, the three kids, husband and wife, we used to all sit together at the kitchen table and eat. Same start and finish time. We used to then, at some time in the evening, do an activity together. Either a board game, a discussion, watch a TV show. But we don't do the same thing at the same time anymore. So you see, as with words like love, togetherness, trust, communication, there's different definitions. We really need to sort through that with our couples. Because I find that that's oftentimes one of the big sources of conflict. Another exercise that I will have people do, and this has to do more with the people, quote, outside the relationship or the marriage. This exercise is called set your marriage table. The idea is, you know, like when you're planning for a wedding or an event, you arrange a seating chart. And what they look at is separately each person to fill in who would they invite to this event, and then where do they place each person in terms of the seating chart. And they actually suggest that about once a year, the couple goes through and reevaluates this and then creates some discussion. Now, this might be something you want the couple to do in your office so that you can monitor. How can we build healthy relationships? We've talked a lot about the elements of toxic relationships, how to recognize them, how to set healthy boundaries. I like using solution-focused approaches in work. One of the things that we can do is we can complement what goes well. Usually, one of the first few sessions when I realize I'm going to be doing marriage or relationship counseling, I'm looking at what has gone well. How has the couple stuck together to this point through other bumps in the road? What's made a positive difference? What behaviors or attitudes actually help? And making sure the couple has time to look at what has worked and how they can keep that working. We can change our language, and solution-focused therapy is a lot about creating a strengths approach, about using positive language. So instead of my husband or wife is stubborn and selfish, saying something like, I'm encouraged. I'm married to a person who knows what he believes in. Wow, what a different tone just listening to that. What about my spouse is a lazy bum who just wants to fly by the seat of his or her pants. He or she never prepares for anything. Well, I remember when I first met my spouse, and I really liked how spontaneous they were. I tend to be very planned and organized, and it's hard for me to be that spontaneous. I just wish sometimes that they were less spontaneous when we had certain things to get done. You see how different the tone is? What about using a solution-focused approach when someone's saying, my friend is boring, dull, never lets us have fun. They're so frugal all the time. It's difficult for me sometimes going out with a friend when I know we have to stay on a budget. But that means there's more money left over for next time that we go out or for other things that we really should be focusing on. My coworker is so planned and uptight about everything. What would be a solution-focused way of looking at that? My coworker prides him or herself on doing things according to policy. What about this last example? My classmate just has unrealistic expectations. They think things turn out right if you just wait and trust. I admire that my classmate has faith that the things will turn out right in the end. That's a different approach than I usually take. But there may be some benefits to it too. So dealing with emotional manipulators and toxic people, we can actually empathize with the helplessness they feel. We can look at the underlying schemas. We can try to not polarize them as all good or all bad. We can take responsibility for our part, but in our I message, find a way to make sure that they make a choice about what they take responsibility for. Remind the other toxic person that this isn't a personal battle. If you're saying a boundary, it's not personal against them. The key is sticking to the I message. Sticking to the boundary. Set boundaries and live them. Be the boundary, as I just said a little bit ago. Model mutual respect. Actively listen. Discern the schemas, as I said. Apologize if you need to. In terms of making long-term behavior changes, there's an acronym. Dig deep. Dig. The D means be deliberate in your thoughts and behaviors. I, be inspired to make new and different choices. And G, to take new actions. One of the things we can work with our clients on is how to tell their story, how to help them come up with new narratives. Oftentimes they're coming to us because of the presenting problems. Brené Brown, who has a lot of literature out there on shame, says, shame hates when we reach out and tell our story. It hates having words wrapped around it. It can't survive being shared. Shame loves secrecy. The most dangerous thing to do after a shaming experience is to hide or bury our story. When we bury our story, the shame metastasizes. Telling our story actually breeds compassion. It moves away from fear. Helps connection take place. Helps reinforce that there are options about how to go about things. It helps us tell really what's in our heart that oftentimes with a toxic person and other people out there don't get to hear. One of the questions that one of my clients asked in the past, she said, well, what if I use an I message and the other person doesn't change? And I explained that the purpose of the I message isn't to make the other person change. Sometimes the I message just helps us hear what's in our heart, what's our values and beliefs, to reinforce what is it that we want in this relationship. So telling our story, we want to move away from shame, which has been called the swampland of the soul, and polarizes things instead of looks at behavior. If we live in love with our whole hearts and we want to engage with the world from a place of worthiness, we have to talk about things that get in the way, fear, shame, and vulnerability. So we'll help a client develop their narrative. And it should be what they call in the literature a restorative narrative. By the end of the story, there should be new activities that have to do with coping with grief and stress in a positive way. Grief is part of the human experience. We can help our clients focus on what good comes out of the bad. We can create a solution focused. We can maybe affirm them returning to some healthy spirituality. We can help instill hope that the story is still ongoing. The last chapter has not been written. That there's more to the story still. There's different reactions to offenses. And the reason I include this is because a lot of times people tend to think that they must have an ongoing relationship as it was before with a toxic person. But the fact of the matter is, we do have choices. Dr. Janice Abrams-Spring talks about four types of reactions to offenses. The first one's cheap forgiveness, then refusing to forgive, and the last two being just acceptance of how the other person is, and finally, genuine forgiveness. In cheap forgiveness, there's really no processing of emotions. Things are just swept under the rug. And that's usually what happens in these toxic relationships that we've been talking about today. It's really a premature false forgiveness. It could lead to the person who's doing it thinking they're morally superior. It could set the hurt party up for health and emotional problems. Maybe they just don't want to end the relationship, so they say they forgive in words and act like they forgive, but really it doesn't resolve any issues. There's no vulnerability. There's no boundary setting. There's no working through. Any genuine, real forgiveness or reevaluation of a relationship is really going to involve what the literature talks about as a intimate back and forth dance of working through some of these issues. So cheap forgiveness is really not helpful. Refusing to forgive. This is if you really feel angry about the offense. This is not necessarily a healthy thing because it's control and punishment based. It fosters a sense of impotence and invulnerability. If people usually have polarized thinking and there's no room for forgiveness, they may do this refusing to forgive. The things that we're looking at primarily in terms of counseling are either acceptance or reconciliation, genuine forgiveness. Again, redefining the relationship with boundaries. Acceptance means there is some level of working through. The person who is hurt or offended feels all the emotions and does not bypass the work of the wounded party. They promote healthy self-care. Sometimes the person who's done the offense isn't around, but acceptance can be a useful thing in counseling because it helps the person who's hurt to realize that they're putting the toxic person's behavior in context. They can let go of unhealthy responsibility for someone who won't take responsibility for themselves. Genuine forgiveness, like I said, is an intimate dance between the offender and the offended. The offender recognizes and verbalizes his or her need to be forgiven. Each person's taking responsibility for his or her part. This isn't something that just happens automatically. It's really worked at. I've had couples that it can take a good 9 months or more to really work through when there's offenses, especially if there are offenses that tap into long-term schemas about things. The offender expresses genuine remorse and a plan to avoid toxic behavior in the future. They hear the depth of the pain that was caused. They allow for discussion about behavioral requests of what are we going to do from here to make things better. So as we work with clients about transitioning to healthier relationships, we look at becoming authentic, helping people have courage to become who they are, allowing them to be vulnerable, realizing that everyone has strengths and weaknesses, we can avoid these absolute negative ways of looking at things. And that resilience really only comes when we've actually worked through some stresses. Resilience is what helps us realize that we have resources within us, emotionally and behaviorally, that we can apply. That there's nothing wrong with using resources around us, other people. It's not weak or wrong to connect with others. Now, as we go through the end of the seminar, we're going to close with some codependency scenarios, looking at how we would treat some of these different scenarios. In the first one, Kathy, a 45-year-old woman, enters counseling for depression. She describes being constantly tearful and unable to be very hopeful about the future. She suffered a recent breakup from a 3-year relationship with someone she was sure was much better than the previous guys. She describes so much love, passion, and connection between the two of them. Previous to this 3-year relationship, she had 4 marriages. She is confused as to why so many people, including multiple friends and family members, tell her she's the ideal type of woman everyone wants. She said she doesn't know how to love just a little. She dives in head over heels and gives her all to someone. I'm devoted, loyal, and can always be counted on, she says. She adds that she stands by her man no matter what. One of her previous husbands went through multiple inpatient alcohol detoxes and several rehabs over the course of about 10 years. Another one had traumas from his past, and she stood by him while he walked through all of them. Her presenting concern is that now she's become tearful, and she has overwhelming sadness. She doesn't know why. She has life stresses and people don't reach out the same way to her. Her mother's ailing. She has Alzheimer's and needs to be put in a nursing facility. But she's finding no one is around for her like I am for them. She says she's never felt so confused because the more she gives, helps, and stands by others, the less she sees it being reciprocated by those she's in intimate relationships with. As she comes to you for her initial diagnostic session, she just cries, why? A lot of different angles we can go with this counseling session. We always want to start with developing a therapeutic connection, with understanding, with empathizing. She's definitely going through some depression, some grief. I mean, I don't know if she's even worked through the loss of 4 marriages. That's a lot of time. And it sounds like there's a value here that we may want to check in with her about, a value that being in relationship is more important than being out of relationship. A value of keeping things going and not being, quote, a failure. There's probably some schemas and some assumptions. We may want to do some thought work with her about any of those. It sounds like sticking around no matter what is one of the beliefs that she has. I might tend to, after some time of building empathy and connection, when it would be the right timing, talk with her about, do the rules and guidelines that she's used to apply to the 4 men she's been married to and anyone else she's been in relationship with, do they apply to her? Does she get that level of care? It doesn't sound like it because she sounds angry. She sounds frustrated, overwhelmed, and tearful from this narrative. Now she has a mom with Alzheimer's. And I'm wondering if for her, asking for help is difficult. That's something I'd probably explore with her. A lot of times there's also an assumption on the part of the codependent person that they feel like they're less caring and less giving. if they were to set a boundary. So that's one of the assumptions I probably work through with her as well. There may be issues with shame. Remember, shame says you're a bad person rather than your behavior's bad. She may be falsely thinking that since she couldn't make her past husbands take responsibility for their emotional healing, their addictions, and other things, that is her fault. There's a lot of grief work. You hear her crying and saying, why? We need to help her transition away from this unhealthy why to some more behavioral way of looking at it. What next? How am I going to approach things when the way that I've been approaching them hasn't worked so well? Let's look at a second example. Paul wants to be in a good relationship with a nice woman by his side. But woman after woman complains that just when an issue needs to be discussed, he clams up, crosses his arms, and doesn't know what to say. His current girlfriend constantly questions, "Why don't you want to talk to me about things?" He finally yells, stating, "I don't know how the hell to do this. What are the rules anyway? Of when to talk, how to talk, how this communication stuff goes." His girlfriend Amy says he's either quiet or withdrawn or angry and explosive. They both are at a point where they say they can't do this communication thing on their own. So they're eliciting your help. So let's take a look at this. First of all, it would probably make a difference as to who's coming in for counseling. If Paul's coming in, or Amy, or both of them. Sounds like they both have some assumptions about how conflict is supposed to be addressed. I think I would try and start out by teaching the foundations of the I message, of the perspective taking. They obviously both feel that their approach is better than the other one's, but I would also offer some guidelines that I'm not the referee, that we're not going to look at which approach is better or worse. We're going to create some guidelines of actually planning for conflict. As I said before, usually couples will say planning for conflict. But we'll talk about how we can plan for conflict, what roles each of them can be. Remember when I said with couples, a lot of times one tends to be more pulling for engagement, wanting to constantly talk, wanting to deal with things. It sounds like Amy's that one in this example, and Paul's more like, gosh, you know, I'm just going to stay out of this. This is just too overwhelming. So what we want to do is create a pause when things feel like they can't be resolved, but then give some tools for timing when they're going to come back and work on things, and what that would look like. Let's look at the next example here. Ruby is known for being an intense, colorful, and charismatic woman. "That's exactly why I love her," Bob says. However, though Ruby is hypnotic and masterful and in charge in the bedroom, she has difficulty developing healthy reactions in situations where she does not feel in control. Sometimes when Bob gets sent out for business projects, Ruby feels a heightened sense of insecurity and fear. She despises the uncertainty of not being physically able in every situation with Bob to mentally, being physically able to be in every situation with Bob. She tends to jump to other conclusions. If he's gone, maybe a business trip is really an affair with another woman. Maybe going to a grocery store helping with car repairs are really something else. She only feels good when she's physically with her man, on her arm, close to home. She likes the feeling of being one, not knowing where she starts and ends, or where Bob starts or ends. If there's a break in this oneness, like when Bob is a business trips, Ruby's heart races and has panic attacks. She experiences his time away as loss, rejection, and abandonment. She reacts the same, like it's a death, because to her, any distance is loss. Bob simply doesn't know what more to do when Ruby reacts this way. He loves her enthusiasm and eagerness to make the relationship work, but is concerned about her faulty assumptions regarding innocent things like required business trips. Ruby wants her fears addressed as to why Bob is backing away from her. So let's take a look at this third example. The first thing that comes to mind is when we talked about the concept of limerence. Someone basically changing depending on the relationship they're in. It seems like if Ruby's not physically and emotionally very deeply connected and physically around Bob, that she has a meltdown. It's difficult for her to deal with these waves of insecurity and fear. This is one type of codependency. We can find that people are intense and charismatic and whatever in one area, like it says here in the bedroom, but then terrified in another area. She likes to be in control, it says. Otherwise, she experiences panic attacks. We definitely would have to do some cognitive behavioral work on these assumptions. Either it might include something like some specific behavior request of Bob to help reassure her that he is where he is, or just helping her do some cognitive debating strategies. She's stuck through the relationship, and that's something I'd wonder about, is she continues to stick through the relationship even though she supposedly has these doubts. I'd want to explore more about, are these doubts really founded or are they unfounded? Bob's also stuck in the relationship. So we could use some strengths-based or solution-focused approaches because they both continue to be in the relationship. So that shows me some level of commitment. We might want to do some individual work with each as well as some work together. Let's look at our next example of David. David has learned to be what he considers a helpful, chivalrous man. He tends to find women who are in rough situations in life, have been hurt in relationships, or need a hero. Growing up, his dad died when he was 3 years old, so he became the man of the house at a young age. He learned to comfort and console his mom. He is used to being a problem solver and fixer, and prides himself in being in that role. In jobs, he has excelled as a manager, especially on creative development projects. He does not understand why his partner Richard won't let him take care of and manage things. Richard, who David believes is a little lazy and passive-aggressive at times, has grown to resent David's trying to help and fix everything. Richard feels like David's life is a project to be managed, or an issue to be fixed, rather than a relationship to be enjoyed. They want to explore whether or not their relationship is workable, as Richard is tired of feeling everything he is or does is just another mistake to be corrected. David wants to understand why Richard does not appreciate his leadership skills that were once admired. So again, there are some assumptions on both of their part. David likes to be in the position of being in charge in a relationship. He likes to be helpful. He likes to be helpful to these women who have been hurt. He likes to be reassuring. He likes to be a hero. He likes to be the fixer and problem-solving person in his relationship with Richard. It sounds like he has assumptions of what that means. I would explore with both of them about what their Ten Commandments of a Healthy Relationship are. David thinks that Richard really used to appreciate him, doing things for him, helping, fixing, problem-solving. I'm not sure if that was the case and things really changed, or if Richard just got fed up enough and said, man, you don't have to do everything for me. So we might need to look at their operational definitions of that fixer, problem solver, solution. We might also want to look at roles. Remember that territorial method that we talked about who owns the task and who executes the task? We might want to go through some of that with them. Let's look at the fifth example here. Patsy has learned to not rock the boat. She recalls at a young age not speaking of family secrets about her dad and uncles molesting her sisters and other cousins. Now she's torn between speaking up or just carrying her stress in silence regarding something she observes on her job. On the one hand, she knows she can only do so many tasks and can't take it anymore without a commensurate raise. However, she hates taking risks to speak her concerns because she's sure no one will hear her out. If anything, they may fire her. Throughout her life, her core belief she learned was that risks are never worth it. Anytime she considers speaking up, she recalls time in which she was met with fear and criticism and jumping to negative conclusions. In one way, she wonders why she would start speaking up now. But on the other hand, she thinks if she does not speak up, her resentments about unfair treatment will only build. She needs better pay for tasks she's doing on the job. Assertiveness is a word she's never heard nor understands. She states that she does not want to be mean, but she knows waiting and holding all her feelings in is not helping her either. So we see off the bat, there's assumptions. There's thought patterns. Don't rock the boat. Don't share what you're thinking or feeling. She goes from, if I share, I'm going to get fired. People won't want to hear me. I think cognitive behavioral work would be in order for her. She's feeling a sense of injustice, but yet I'm not sure she's communicating it to others. She might think she is. Maybe she's rolling her eyes or pouting or not doing as hard of a work as she was before. But I might talk with her some about what are the desired behaviors and the desired response. And then what is she doing to communicate that? Let's look at the next example here of Diane. Diane was taught growing up that children are to be seen and not heard. The parents are the ones who control and set the environment. Kids have no say about it, but their jobs are to obey and comply or face the consequences and wrath of the parent in charge. Growing up, she tried to be the good, compliant kid, to find ways to be validated and approved of by her parents. But she found that it brought on more fear and caution than anything. Now Diane is coming to you for counseling because she and her husband are parents of a 10-year-old son, a 5-year-old son, and a 4-year-old daughter. As parents, they have different lifestyles. Her husband, Paul, grew up in a home where children were allowed to have a sense of wonder and explore. She never had that luxury. She just does not understand it. She's butting heads with her kids, especially during times when they upset the order she sets in place as a parent. Who ever heard that children are to be seen and not heard? What happened to that? My children all have minds of their own. And my husband, as well as teachers in school, are teaching them to be free thinkers and express. How do I tolerate this contention anymore? How would you handle Diane and her husband and family and counseling? If possible, I think it would be great for Diane to have her own therapist, the husband to have his own therapist, and the kids to have a separate therapist at first, and then maybe every so often them to have some meetings together. We want to make sure that the parents are able to have enough of a united front with the kids. And if the kids are perceiving that division and that difference and that fighting, that's going to only add to their behavior problems or their concerns. So it may be helpful to work with the parents first, make sure there's a united front. But it also may be helpful to talk with the kids in separate sessions and find out what they think the rules of the family are. Let's look at the next example here about Luann. Luann becomes angry around and different around each guy she's with. Her friends are concerned for her. Around certain guys, she's a soft, gentle, passive caretaker who never questions anything, but is loyal and devoted to others' every wish. Around other guys who want her to speak up, she's suddenly talkative, creative, and hardworking, and a leader with no spare time for any of her prior interest. Regardless of what type of guy she's around, she transforms. When asked about it by friends, she explains, Wouldn't you be fearful of the relationship ending or a fight if you don't compromise and accommodate? Relationships are about compromise and accommodation. You have to do that to make things work. How about yourself, one friend chimes in. If he doesn't like it, it's not meant to be. That's so cold and not meeting him part way, responds Luann. All people are supposed to change in relationships to make the relationships work. How would you deal with her in treatment? So we have a core belief here about compromise being essential in a relationship. And I'd want to definitely explore that about compromise and accommodation. There's a reason her friend is concerned about Luann. We also, again, see, like I mentioned in one of the other cases, that limerence at work here where she's becoming different around different people. So that's something that I might talk with her about. I might also have her operationally define a little more what that compromise and stuff looks like so I understand that. And then work through some boundary setting and assertiveness. Not starting with no. Not starting with trying to make the other person do all their part, because that wouldn't work for her since she's focused on this idea of compromising. But creating that healthy wait, creating some time where she could care for herself in the midst of things, that might be a good starting point. Now let's look at this example of Nick. Nick is known as the good guy. He has big, broad shoulders and can take on the world, everyone says. When you need a helping hand, he's the one to go to. Sean just fell at a sports game and Nick stopped everything to take him for medical care. Jim had a fight with his ex and needed to get out and talk and explore a new living arrangement. Patrick is making some changes with his business and requires Nick's assistance. Don has some house projects he could use a helping hand on. Nick knew he specifically took a few days off his job to recoup and do things he needed to do for himself. However, now all these requests for help are coming in. He's always been a kind, helpful soul. But what if he doesn't intervene now? What will people think? Will he suddenly be less of a friend, be branded not helpful, or be told he's selfish? Nick spends hours trying to think of a good enough explanation to tell the friends. He couldn't just tell them he's taken time off and his previous commitments, could he? That would be rude, cruel, and insensitive. So, boundary setting is difficult for Nick. He was able to take a few days off, but it sounds like he didn't tell anyone that ahead of time. So again, there's that assumption there that being available for everyone, being kind, being caring, always being the one to intervene is the way to go. I would definitely have some discussion with him about differentiating between caring for and caring about. I would talk about what does he feel the price is going to be that he's paying if he continues taking on everybody's stuff. Now, I have clients that come to me for Christian and spirituality-based counseling, and one of the things that we've talked about sometimes has been, do you feel that everything that you're taking on is really God's mission for you? is every person that possibly crossed your path supposed to be something you're supposed to do? Is it possible that there's someone else out there who actually could help? And what would these people do if you weren't available? So there's a lot of ways that we can approach that. And we'll definitely have to look at self-care. Because obviously there's a part of him intuitively that's telling Nick, I need a break. Otherwise he wouldn't have taken those days off. So his behaviors and his words are all kind of giving different messages. And I would talk with him about, make sure what it is you're teaching people by your actions. Let's look at this next example of Bonnie and Laura. Bonnie and Laura spent all their time together. What would we do if we didn't have each other, they thought. They're so close, they finish each other's sentences. They know each other's thoughts. They know that you never see one without the other. After 5 years, Laura is noticing that other friends of theirs sometimes spend time apart. She's beginning to feel frustrated with always being defined by being someone with someone all the time. Laura says, well, we do business together all day. We have dinner at night. We take care of our house together. We do hobbies and free activities together. It started out amazing because we're exactly the same. But now I'm sad, tearful, and wondering if there's more to life than this. Is there more to life? Apart from Bonnie? Laura is fearful she'll never find out other parts of herself if she does not spend some time apart from Bonnie. But she's also concerned if she fully tells Bonnie how she's feeling, Bonnie will feel threatened about their relationship ending and react strongly. So it sounds like there's been a long-term ingrained behavior pattern here. They've been together through everything, through businesses and home chores and social activities. And so I think we'd have to look at the assumptions behind that. Definitely their behavior has told each other that, yeah, we do everything together. And there may be assumptions that if there's any differences in their personality, that's a bad thing. So we may need to actually test that out. And well, what if they had some differences? I might even check with Laura and say, you know, I can't imagine that over the years that there's not been at least a few things that the two of you had that you actually had difference of approaches about, difference of opinion. And so we might start with some small things and helping her to talk with Bonnie about when they have differences of opinion, what that looks like. Now we have the case of Amanda. Amanda's been feeling stressed out on her job. There's been a lot of personality dynamics of strong opinions, of people fighting around her. And it keeps escalating. She tries not to rock the boat and just keep peace, but she's getting a lot of panic attacks now, even being at work. She recalls also having this problem in dating relationships. There's times when she's totally at odds with what her partner believes, yet she doesn't verbalize her thoughts or opinions because she'd rather not hurt them than share her opinions. This has always been a pattern in her life. As a child, she was raised with the idea that children should be seen and not heard. Mom and Dad's opinions were the only reality that mattered. There was no room for normal awe and wonder. Everything had to be censored. Live for and adapt to others to maintain peace. But the sad thing is that the lessons about maintaining peace of others only served to unleash an inner war within Amanda, as her reality was never validated. So we see a lot of schemas going up. We see don't rock the boat is one of the main ones. I would probably use a counseling session to start to role play ways of approaching supervisors at work or others. Doing some role plays, and that there's ways of sharing that are still sensitive and still following company policy. Let's look at this next example of Joan. Joan always hoped one day she'd meet the right one. But since her other brothers and sisters were all tied down with their families, and she did not have something better to do, the relatives decided that at age 48, she'd be the perfect person to stay in the family home and take care of the ailing, immobile, feeble mother. Being the kind, giving person, she reconciled herself to the fact that she'll never be able to be married, never be able to have a life of her own. She'll never be able to have her own hopes and dreams. Maybe this is her lot in life, she thinks. Maybe she should just date, and when the home health nurse is there, have a gentleman over when her mom's asleep. I learned to put my own interests on the back burner, she would tell everyone. Deep down at times after her mother went to sleep, she'd sit in the recliner and cry, imagining hopes and dreams that she knows will never come to pass. So the thing that I hope that you're seeing in the pattern of these examples and throughout today's seminar is the ingrained belief system. I'm only caring, I'm only helpful, I'm only giving if I sacrifice myself. It may take different forms in each of these cases, but it's something in terms of cognitive behavioral treatment that will need to be assessed anytime we have someone that's placing others' needs ahead of their own or who's allowing relationships. Now, you might think, oh, well, this wasn't really a toxic relationship. She's having to take care of her ailing, feeble mother. But the fact is there's toxicity in the family messages, in the message that, well, you don't have a partner, you don't have whatever, you're the one this gets dumped on. So there's still a level of the family, the brothers, the sisters, the other relatives, not taking responsibility for any part in things and making assumptions. So these principles we've talked about today would still apply in this example. Let's look at just a few more here and then we'll be winding up. Wilma, a divorced mom of a 26-year-old, comes to counseling talking about how she just has to get her grown son over the next hurdle. She reports how her son had his fifth DUI, lost his recent job, gets in fights with a girlfriend, and ends up on her doorstep for help after his drug use. Wilma began a third job, despite saying she has no time when she was juggling the other two jobs. She describes her fears. How if she just gets him over this recent hurdle, things will be better. However, after counseling Wilma over six sessions, you realize her pattern is always trying to get people over life's hurdles. She figures, if only I can help my son, my disabled friends, and others, then when they're better, I can possibly do something for myself. However, her behavior shows she will always say yes to helping others, even when it's burdening her. I actually had a case that was parallel to this. I've had more than one, actually. And that was pretty much what the one woman said. I have to get my son through this. I have to get him over this hurdle. And I had to ask her in terms of concrete behaviors, how will you know when you've gotten him over this hurdle? And again, we had to challenge that language of I have to. It's my responsibility to do this for him. We had to look at that. We had to look at what her words were saying and what her behaviors were saying. We had to look at how will he know that he's supposed to be responsible? What will you say or do? What will others say or do? How will he know that if you're rescuing him? Let's look at the example of Michael. Michael, a 50-year-old man, is often criticized by his friends and colleagues because he's silent in discussions. He becomes defensive. You don't have to be all. If he doesn't keep his feelings in, he said it'll be a living hell. His ex will throw things, scream, and drink alcohol. He'll have to walk on eggshells around her because he feels as if only her world matters. Most of the time he feels trapped in an internal world of fear. He knows it'll be a steep price emotionally to pay if he has to say anything after what he's felt over the last 10 years. He felt like something significant has happened actually inside him. Now he's vacillating between depression and anger. He realizes or feels as if he's never mattered. Yet he discovered he had to cry his tears in secret and sweep his anger under the rug. He would bury his feelings under workaholism or go straight to his room to play video games rather than interacting with his wife. He would try to start a new relationship now that he and his wife are divorced, but he's fearful that how can he deal with another relationship if he can't even take care of himself. So in this last example, this last codependency scenario, we see that he prioritized the ex-wife's needs over his own. There was a message in his mind that her alcoholism, her anger, her screaming, her drinking had to receive more attention than anything he needs. And so we have to look at that core message. It's possible that he came from an alcoholic family. It's possible that there are some schemas and some beliefs, cognitive beliefs from the past, that you put others first. But it's interesting that after all that he's been through, there's a part of him that wants to consider a new relationship. So we could use some strengths-based work to talk about how he thinks of other people, but again, differentiating between that caring for and caring about. I want to thank you for participating in today's seminar about I Don't Know Who I Am, Dealing with Toxic Relationships. I hope this seminar has been helpful to you, and I wish you well in your counseling and psychotherapy work.